thing is, even if the U.S. leaves, this is also the counterpoint, is that there could be, you know, Chinese investment. China is right across the border from Afghanistan. They're very keen on working with the Afghan government, and they don't care about the nature of the government per se. They're willing to work with them regardless. I would say from the perspective of Afghans, and this includes the Taliban, if they're in power now, which seems likely, they do need to have a good relationship with the U.S. and the West as much as possible, because you don't want to be in a situation where your only foreign partner, your major foreign partner, is just one country. That country would be China. You want to be able to have leverage. You want to be able to have, you know, leverage parties against each other, have a cooperative relationship with the West as the alternate power broker. So, you know, I think that's also why they're trying to be as conciliatory as possible right now in their messaging. They're helping facilitate now the withdrawal of Americans and some Afghan allies of the United States from the country. They're not killing them or trying to prevent them to do that. They're trying to be perceived as a responsible partner with the international community as much as possible. And secondly, they would like, once the U.S. leaves, to not be an implacable enemy, but view them with some degree of nuance, so that they can continue getting some cooperation on things of shared interest.
I'm sure. So they, you know, they need expertise. Like if you have various rare earth substances in the ground, you got to have some tools to get it out of the ground and ways to deliver whatever that stuff is. And that's not always easy. It could be in the ground, but if you can't get it from point A to point B, you can't make any money. So they know they have to do that. Let me just see where we are. A little bit of noise there. As I've said, it's one thing to wage a war, to attack and tear down your enemy. It's quite another to govern. Now is the hard part for the Taliban. You quote Shah Zaman Farahi, who served as an economist in the Afghan Ministry of Finance until last year. He said, if the Taliban wants to continue with the current government civil staff structure and existing services such as health, education, and other basics, let alone expand and deliver more services, they will need international aid, end of quote. Why? Say more about what he's saying there. Why will they need that?
Well, you know, like I mentioned earlier, the Afghan government is very reliant on international aid to fund basics of life in Afghanistan, like healthcare, food, provision of food and things like that. If that aid was suddenly pulled, there would be a humanitarian crisis tomorrow. It would be very devastating, and they don't want that to happen. They want the country to remain stable. So that's what Mr. Farahi is referring to, the prospect of that aid being pulled and what would happen if that happened. And he was in favor of it, actually, because he wants to put pressure on the current government. But he even acknowledged that it would be something evil to do, in the sense it would result in a lot of human suffering if that were to happen, which the Taliban wants to avoid now because they're in charge of the country.
Yes, they are. And again, for those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. And, you know, we can't impose democracy on other countries. We can't. It's barely even democracy here. It's just hanging by a thread. So we're trying to keep democracy alive. Anyway, our guest today is Murtaza Hussein, and we're discussing his article in The Intercept called The International Response to the Taliban's Ascent Will Shape Afghans' Fate. Without this aid, in terms of having the ability to pay for technical expertise and for qualified people just to keep the government functioning, isn't there a huge risk of losing the hearts and minds of the people? So, in other words, might a failure of the Taliban to govern and hold on to power serve the game plan of the U.S. and other Western powers? Or perhaps it could have the effect of pressuring the government to modify its behavior on human rights. Could it backfire, the people perceiving it as being, you know, Afghanistan's being held hostage, as with Cuba, and then only strengthen the Cuban government? There's concern that that any kind of sanctions or, you know, looking tough because you've been humiliated might further anger and radicalize the population. It seems like it could blow either way, I'm guessing. Your thoughts?
I think that's precisely what people are afraid is going to happen now, and I think, unfortunately, it's quite likely they're going to, they're angry now. They feel humiliated about what happened. And they would like, they don't want the next government that comes into power to be successful, because that would compound the humiliation of losing the war in the first place. It's not to say the Taliban is destined to be successful anyways. They have serious problems governing. Much of the country rejects them. They're not a national liberation movement. They're basically a movement which came to power because everybody agreed that they hated the previous government imposed by the U.S. so much. Now, that said, you know, if by some chance they do come to power and they do govern reasonably well, or if they govern better than the U.S. did when they were in Afghanistan, it would be profoundly humiliating. It would be a huge repudiation to everything that happened there the last 20 years. And, you know, if you look, like, not to go so far back, Cuba is a great example, but if you go even further back, if you look at Haiti and other countries that maybe humiliated a more powerful country, France in that case, and, you know, they were quite vindictive about it, in terms of what they did later on, imposing sanctions, and, you know, charging them with all these debts, things like that. So I wouldn't put that past them. I wouldn't say that that's impossible to happen now. And, you know, it would be worse for Afghans because, you know, they didn't choose for the Taliban to take over the country. Most of them were against them. But they will suffer now if there's a conflict between the U.S. and the Taliban. It won't be the U.S. that the Taliban government suffers per se. They'll have access to the state. They'll have ability to provide for themselves and the government to a certain degree. It will be ordinary people who suffer.
That's interesting that they didn't, the Taliban was not the choice of the majority of the people. Any, I mean, we don't have polling going on in Afghanistan, I don't think. I wonder how much of the population really has supported the Taliban. I mean, it's often the case in many, many different wars where whoever can kick out the occupier is the one who gets the support of the people, because they're, you know, even though the people don't really like them particularly, but they're the ones who can best kick out the occupier. Any sense of the support that the Taliban have had, like what kind of percentage in the country? I mean, maybe it's just a wild guess. I have no idea.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say. It's difficult to say. But, you know, I think it's what you said, that they were the people who were against the people everybody hated.
Yeah.
And that was enough to generate a coalition that led to the expulsion of those people. And as a result, here we are. And what happens next is unclear to anybody.
And perhaps you've seen the classic film about the American War in Vietnam, Hearts and Minds. Anybody who hasn't seen it, I highly recommend it. Basically, in that the U.S. puppet governments in South Vietnam never had the hearts and minds of the people, just never had it. To many people, it has appeared similar in Afghanistan, that the government of Kabul was quite distant to the majority of the people. A strong central government strikes me, and again, this is sort of a guess, as kind of a Western construct, not in the historical context of former Persian and Ottoman empires, central, powerful central governments. There are local leaders, often called tribal warlords in the Western media, and I suppose sometimes it's true. Is the Taliban different enough from the Western imposed ideal of you know, powerful central government? What are the chances of it creating a governing structure that will be able to hold on to the hearts and minds across Afghanistan? It is quite a challenge.
It's a good question. I think that ultimately, it's a very diverse country. It's geographically difficult to control by any one central power, as you said. All I can say is that I think that they may have a better chance of creating a system that makes sense than the U.S. did, because the U.S. came to the country without any understanding of history, even a grasp of language. You know, one way or another, these people are from there, and it's up to them to figure out how to live. And if someone else came to the United States and started reorganizing things using violence and money on a grand scale without knowing anything about the history of the country, the divisions in the country, or anything else, you know, I can't imagine that they'd do a better job than even my most disfavored group of United Americans, who at least, you know, live here and understand what the place is like. So, you know, we can only see, but I would say it would be better than the U.S.
I can't help but think so. And, you know, there's the official economy, and then there's the informal economy. In Vietnam, the CIA allegedly worked with local opium organizations, very credible information. I've heard that the U.S. similarly gave kind of a nod and a wink to the traditional opium economy in this otherwise largely infertile chunk of earth. Have we not supported Afghanis' dependence on an opium economy? This underground economy could possibly provide billions of dollars in revenue. What part do you think the opium economy will play from here on out, greater or lesser than the previous government? And what is the Taliban attitude toward the opium economy?
Well, last time they were in power, they banned the production of opium entirely. And then when the U.S. came, somehow the opium production skyrocketed. It became the world's number one source of opium, at least in the, like, Europe and Asia. It's unclear now what's going to happen. There's going to be an ideological pressure to shut down again. It's against their beliefs to have drug production profit off it. But they have a serious economic problem they have to deal with, too. So, to that question, I'm not totally sure. But it's certainly one of the challenges of the next government.
Yeah, well, there's, you know, there's a demand worldwide and there's a supply. I don't know. It's a tough part of capitalism to fight against. And I wonder how poor Afghanis are and how much food insecurity there is. And I wonder about the prospects under the Taliban. And, you know, in most wars, like in Vietnam, I don't think people cared as much about philosophy, political theory, as food, being able to eat. What is the situation with Afghanis and poverty and food insecurity?
It's hard to say. I can only judge by international reporting and statistics. It's bad. The situation is on par with the poorest countries in Asia and even sub-Saharan Africa. That's kind of the situation there right now in that sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of poverty around. And if they can address that, that would help with the hearts and minds, I'm sure. It ain't easy, that's for sure. And Heather Barr, who is interim co-director of the Women's Rights Division at Human Rights Watch, says, we're currently advising donors to Human Rights Watch not to cut off aid, since more than 75% of the previous government's budget was funded by aid money. I would imagine that virtually all such donors were anti-Taliban, especially because of Taliban attitudes toward women. But of course, if their flow of donations comes to an abrupt halt, as Barr says, Afghan women will be the ones hurt most. How will this resolve, do you think? We're talking, you know, about funders, people who send aid money. How do you think this will resolve?
I don't know. It's actually a good question. No one can really answer this question right now. A lot of unknowns at the moment. We can only report what people are asking them to do. And as you said, they're asking not to cut aid. Let's see what happens right now.
Well, we certainly hope they don't. But I can imagine people might, think, well, we hate the Taliban, so we're going to cut them off. And, when there was a boycott of South Africa for its bad policies, a lot of people got hurt. But then again, it did make a change in government. So it might not be off the table as a part of a strategy of putting pressure on the Taliban. Who knows? Time will tell. You point out, quote, the status of women, most of Afghanistan, did not improve much as a result of the U.S. presence. Say more about that, if you would, please. There's a lot of concern about the status and the rights of women. You're saying the status of women did not improve as a result of the U.S. presence. My sense is, and tell me if I'm wrong, that when there was the government that the Russians supported, women had a lot of rights. They could go to work, they could go to school, but then it was shut down. How did the status of women fare under the U.S. presence?
Yeah, there was differences between urban and rural women in Afghanistan, of course. So basically, in urban areas, like I mentioned earlier, there was some change or improvement in the status of women. But, 90% of the country is rural, so those women did not see much improvement at all, and their lives got a lot worse because there's a war going on. So, this whole thing that it was for the benefit of women, it's very blinkered. It's looking at the very small percentage of the population and ignoring a much larger percentage, which is suffering as a result of the war being waged there.
And some Democrats in Congress in the U.S., notably women, have very strenuously objected to Biden's pullout. These are Democrats, citing concerns about women in Afghanistan. Clearly, our military cannot stay forever. 20 years is long enough, especially since it just didn't have any real support. You say the return of the Taliban marks a potentially dire turning point for educated urban women. End of your quote. The women are making a point to stand up before, or the Taliban, rather, are making the point to stand up before the world, insisting they've changed, that women will not lose their rights, they will be able to hold down jobs, girls can go to school. That would be a really big shift indeed. How and when will it be clear how real their new cultivated image is? And how can the world not just trust, but verify? What can be done to verify, not just trust? When can we judge on this?
Well, you know, you can judge by the level of access that they give to international groups to monitor what's actually happening in the country. It'll take time. It'll take time to actually verify what's going on or get a sense of what's happening. But you see, if they close the country off and let anyone see what's going on, then inevitably there will be something they're hiding. But if they allow access and they allow international groups and the press to monitor freely to some degree, then we can have greater confidence of what's actually going on, how it matches their rhetoric.
That's obviously true. You know, if they allow access, if they allow people to come in and see the reporters, I would think they would see that it's in their interest to do so, but I'm not running the show over there. And again, looking at history, the U.S. at the very least enabled the rise of the Taliban, first by using them to fight the Russians in the context of the Cold War, then refusing their offer to surrender in 2001, shortly after we invaded. People don't remember this, but the Taliban offered to surrender in 2001, but we turned it down. I wonder how the fact that we were the occupiers and the only effective fighting force taking us on was the Taliban. Did we unwittingly consolidate their strength? And if we isolate them, as we did with Cuba, will that effectively push them into more radicalism? What do you think?
Certainly possible. Certainly possible. It's hard for me to prognosticate what's going to happen, but you know, it's just that if you don't give them a stake in what's happening, any party, not just them, but any party you have a dispute with, you don't give them a stake in the future, then you're just going to radicalize, and they have no reason to compromise on the issues that you find important in your dealings with them. So they're no different. And it depends really how the U.S. approaches things now, whether they have a stable equilibrium with them or whether they return to the cycle of conflict which led to the war in the 90s.
Yeah, again, we will see. One of the excuses used to legitimize our invasion of Afghanistan was the allegation that Afghanistan was harboring terrorists, letting themselves be used as a base for international terrorist groups. And as you mentioned, and this may surprise a lot of people, they didn't like ISIS. The question is, will this happen again? And beyond that, is there a universally accepted definition of terrorist? What do you think will happen with, you know, the international terrorist groups that had at least allegedly used Afghanistan as a base for operations throughout the rest of the world? And do they have a clear understanding of what is a terrorist?
Well, you know, like I said, it's hard for me to prognosticate. But as I said before, you know, they don't want the country to be used to attack the West because it resulted in the destruction of their previous government. So they have strong incentives not to allow that to happen. Regarding definition of terrorism, it's very subjective, as you said. I mean, different people consider the Taliban terrorists. Their supporters do not consider themselves terrorists. They don't consider themselves terrorists. It all depends on the way you look at it. Not really a term that's very useful, in my opinion.
True. One person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist. That was certainly the case in the war against War of Independence in 1776 here. And it's all, you know, all wars really. And as the Intercept News Agency reports, turn on the cable news and you'll hear a parade of ex-military and Bush administration's officials, many with undisclosed ties to defense contractors, castigating President Joe Biden for a crisis of their own making. The American news media, what is the power of their influence? Are they at all open to legitimizing the new Afghan government? I mean, we've seen, you know, it's so much theater that once, you know, a sense of drama starts moving, it's it you know, once the ball starts rolling, that's the way it is. And right now, you know, the new Afghan government is, you know, horrible. ISIS going to cut off heads, things like that. But I wonder about the ties of the former Bush administration people to defense contractors. You know, they're there in the background. They made a lot of money from this. They're one group that made out quite well from, well, this and any war. And do you think, what do you sense of the American media? I'm sure you've had a chance to look at a few of the networks, the cable news, et cetera, networks. Do you sense any consideration of being open to legitimizing and recognizing the new Afghan government? Or are they just going to keep it up?
Well, you know, it's hard to talk with the media per se, usually, because it's not a monolith.
Right.
But in this case, we've seen a pretty, you know, consistent message from at least the mainstream establishment media that they're thinking very personally that the war was lost. I think reasons for that are not totally clear to me why, but they're not happy about it. And, you know, it's not a question about legitimizing it or not. Can they cover this issue fairly and impartially? I'm kind of skeptical that they can. They're taking it very, very personally, almost as though they were combatants in the conflict. No.
Well, of course, many of them were embedded with the soldiers who, you know, if you're embedded, it's a little bit tough to give a neutral report, or close to objective when you're embedded. And, you know, the CIA is not dumb, and all the national security agencies, they know how to influence the news for sure. And so this probably, I mean, not being told what, you know, or hinted at what they should write is challenging for these news reporters, for sure, having to do their own work. I know it's hard to do. For those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking with Murtaza Hussain, who's written The International Response to the Taliban's Ascent Will Shape Afghan's Fate. The Palestinian writer and activist Iyad El-Baghdadi, co-author of The Middle East Crisis Factory, says, having once been an Islamist myself when I was much younger, I can tell you with the wisdom of hindsight that a lot of it is really about identity and very little of it is about spirituality. We feel humiliated by the West and alienated from our own pre-colonial identities. Colonialism and modernity, a perfect storm that severed our connection with ourselves. We say we want to bring Islam back, but what we really want back is our lost selves. What lesson is there in what he said for the Western powers to learn?
That's a good question. I think it's kind of really a lesson for them themselves to learn and to work out what they want that to mean for themselves. My opinion is that the U.S. should just stay out of these countries, and since we can have trade with them, they can have relations with them, and not try to use violence and money to reshape them in their own image. I don't think they even do this with good intentions in the first place. I think they have their own interests in trying to capitalize on in the war, sort of becoming profitable or beneficial to people's careers. That's what happens.
Right.
But yeah, I'd said is I think it's mostly an issue for, you know, people living in these countries to figure out their identities and things like that. It's not for the U.S. to concern itself with or take a great interest in. It's other people's problem.
Yeah, and respecting other people's identities. I know there are people who think the U.S. has to rule the world, that we are the natural leaders of the world, but other people like to have their identities. Imagine that. And it's not what the colonialists want to dictate to them. And just for clarification, there are various different factions of Islam. Is it the case that the Taliban is Sunni and that there are Shia and Sikh and other minorities there as well? Are they Sunni affiliated, or is that, I really don't know. Do you?
Yeah, they're Sunni. They're Sunni. Exactly.
So the only, I was trying to think of other extremist Sunni Islamic governments, and all I can think of is Saudi Arabia. Their treatment of women and of dissent is hardly exemplary, but golly gee, we do a lot of business with them. After America's previous longest war, we finally started to do business with Vietnam, as we could have, beginning when the French lost in 1954. Do you think that, and this is again sort of guessing, you know, looking at crystal ball, but also you know a bit about Afghanistan. Do you think that once it is out of our orbit, like Vietnam became so, and other countries, will we recognize and do business with Afghanistan? I mean, clearly, I would think it's in everybody's best interest to do so, even, I mean, quite perhaps mostly women and girls. Do you think that once, you know, it's completely out of our orbit, that a little bit of time goes by, that they have a somewhat functioning government, that we'll recognize and start to do business with Afghanistan and start to include them in the community of nations?
I don't know. That's a good question. So, like I said, it's hard to sort of prognosticate the future. Maybe if they have some interest in doing so, then they will. But only time will tell.
Only time will tell. Well, if you were running U.S. Foreign policy and relations with Afghanistan and advising President Biden and Secretary of State Blinken, what would you suggest for what we do from here? How's that?
You know, I don't know. I would say, you know, keep an open mind and be pragmatic about what's possible and try to minimize the harm to people in Afghanistan who the U.S. has really taken responsibility for by shaping their country the last 20 years. They can't, you know, have everything they want to have in that country clearly now after the Taliban took it over, but they can at least do what they can to minimize the negative impact on ordinary people now who are going to live under that government.
And, you know, it's interesting. We don't do that in Saudi Arabia. You know, we let them get away with murder, quite literally. And they, you know, they're very brutal, cutting off heads and, you know, really tough on women. Yet we do business with them. Yet they're a strategic ally of ours, the Sunni, you know, extremist government of Saudi Arabia. We do business with them. It's just, you know, ain't nobody's business but my own and their own. I hope we can do it. And I don't know. I think this is an opportunity here, but we will see. So you write regularly for the Intercept. Is that correct? And if people want to read more of your stuff in the Intercept, what can you point them to on that internet thing?
You can follow me on Twitter. I'm on Twitter, MAZMHUSSAIN. That's my Twitter. You follow me there, and my stuff is mostly posted there.
All right. Well, let's hope for better days ahead for Afghanistan. Boy, it sure was a quick end, a long introduction to the end, but let's hope for better things here on out. Hey, thank you so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Thank you for having me. Thanks. И жизни подателю приди, вселися в ны, и очистины от всякие скверны, и спаси Боже души наша.
Cuando grito sin usar la boca y mi furia se come a la gente porque muerde aunque no tenga dientes. El dolor no me causa problema, hoy los dolores recitan poemas. El mundo me lo como sin plato, el miedo a mí me limpia los zapatos. El fuego lo derretió y las pesadillas no duermen porque piensan en mí. Hoy puedo ver lo que el otro no vio y los pongo a rezar aunque no crean en Dios. Hoy las lágrimas lloran antes de morir y a los libros de historia los pongo a escribir que le tiemblen las piernas al planeta Tierra. Hoy yo vine a ganar y estoy hecho de guerra, y hecho de guerra, y estoy hecho de guerra, y estoy hecho de guerra. Estoy hecho de guerra.
pongo a rezar. Soy el boquete que dejó la bomba, que cayó, lo que fecundó la madre que me parió. Desde que nací soy parte de este menú, porque yo llegué al óvulo antes que tú. Soy la selva que corre descalza, en el medio del mar sobrevivo sin balsa. Soy el caudal que mueve la corriente, los batallones que chocan de frente. Mis rivales que vengan de a dos, hoy ni siquiera los truenos me alzan la voz. Soy tu derrota, tus dos piernas rotas, el clavo en el pie que traspasó la bota. Soy la estrategia de cualquier combate, hoy se gana o se pierde, no existe el empate. Soy las penas de tus alegrías, la guerra de noche y la guerra de día. Guerra de noche y la guerra de día. Guerra de noche y la guerra de día. Guerra de noche y la guerra de día.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO Portland, Oregon.
Hi, I'm Phil G. I'm one of the original hosts of KBOO's Grateful Dead and Friends. We're on from noon to 2 on Saturdays. All